Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 27th of November 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com, because we would normally have Dennis Wise with us, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, and other films. Unfortunately, he is still ill. I did get some news from him this week, though. He had took a bit of a turn for the worse last week, but he's stabilised since then, and he's now on a waiting list for some surgery. He seems to be getting better. He was in quite a cheerful mood. He had a message for us saying, don't give up on Trump. There is still mileage in all of this. So he's obviously still able to pay attention to what is going on. He's still in high spirits. I sent him another Get Well Soon card today, and I signed that from myself and also from the listeners. And I know that he's really been appreciating the messages that I've been sending to him. And of course, I've been telling him all the questions that I've been getting about him and sending him all your love out there. Well, as I mentioned, we do have a special guest today, someone I've wanted to get on the show for quite a while, actually. I've been very impressed by the presentations that he did earlier on in the year, looking at events surrounding World War II. And since then, he's done another series, which is more up to date, called Beyond Easy Meat, which is looking at the grooming gangs. And it's another Englishman. He might be Welsh or might be Scottish. I think he's English. But it's Horace is who we have on today. And you'll be able to find his work over there on BitChute. So, Horace, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, Sven. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. I know we've met in real life just for about 2 minutes, but yeah, it was good to meet you. And it's an honour to be on here. And I wish Dennis well. I've watched his videos, and hopefully at some point I'll talk to him as well. We've got sort of a lot of commonality in our perspective, some differences. So it's sort of partly what we're going to talk about today, isn't it? So yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, I came across your presentations earlier on this year in the summer, and I rebroadcasted them at Radio Albion, and people were saying they really enjoyed them. And I think the main point of difference was that your research came from books. I think Dennis was collecting together bits from documentaries, bits from movies, bits from interviews, alternative interviews, whereas your research actually came from some pretty heavy going books, and you were using quotes from the books as well, and the presentation seemed to be very well put together to me. And I hadn't really heard of you before then. It was that was the first time I came across you, and I was really impressed with it, because there isn't that much information that is actually out there. So maybe before we actually get into looking at the videos in detail, I mean, how did you come to be studying revisionist history, and what made you think of actually putting your thoughts into presentations like that for everyone else to learn from?
I think the first trigger for me to start looking at revisionist history, at least of the Second World War, is something I've always been open to. I always, thought, well, I agree with those who say that all history is revisionist history. I think that's a good dictum. But the thing that really triggered me off was I used to visit lewrockwell.com, which is an American libertarian site, sort of, among other things, acts as a news aggregator, and but of things that are of interest to him. It's not the same as Drudge. But one of the things he linked to was Barnick Mosquito, the name of a blog. And that was specializing in revisionist history. And in particular, the first thing that really caught my eye on there was a review of Viktor Suvorov's book. I can't remember what it's called. One of them is called Icebreaker. The other one is The Chief Culprit. That was the one he was reviewing, which blames, the culprit that he refers to is Stalin. And that absolutely shook my thinking about the whole 20th century and the order of things now, which, it's one thing I think comes out clearly from my videos, is that I'm saying that the causes and the outcome and the way we understand the Second World War is vital for understanding how we got to where we are now. And that blog I first came across maybe about 7 years ago or something, started reading more books. The series of videos that I've made, I think, are based on 6 or 7 books, primarily anyway. There's bits from others. But of those, most are mainstream books, or at least books published by mainstream publishers, apart from Joachim Hoffmann's one, Stalin's War of Extermination, and the books that I used from the Institute for Historical Review, which is Mark Webber's thing. Both of those very, very valuable people. So I really, really started looking into it about in the last sort of few years. I quit my job for a while and spent a lot of time reading books. I'm sort of sad to say I've got a job again now, but my book consumption has declined. But I know that it does make for good videos, and I'm really glad that you I'm glad that you sort of noticed that, one of the things that made those videos good was that they were based on books. I would say it's kind of a sad thing as well. I would encourage more and more people to do that. You don't have to commit to a 7-hour long series or whatever, but you can just make a book based on, sorry, make a video based on any book, it really does, because books contain info that simply does not make it into the documentaries and so on, because just there's so much more that you can fit into a book. It's the richest source of insight, I think. But yeah, so I spent the last few years reading. I don't know, my intuition of what books to read, I think, is quite good. And I'm quite good at selecting which ones to spend the time on. And I'd say it's the video that I made called Churchill and the Jews, based on a book of the same name by a Jew himself and who's very much a supporter of Winston Churchill. It's portrayed, it's presented as praise of Churchill for his service to the Jewish power, basically. And I just sort of read it from our point of view, from a pro-white point of view, and came to obviously the opposite conclusion of the author. But I mean, that's no problem, right? You can just go to books that you completely disagree with, because the editorial line is really not what matters. It's the facts. So I think taking that approach has been very fruitful, and it's produced things that people are interested in that they didn't know, but quite a bit of what I've said people seem not to know about before. And also, it's derived from sources that anyone who wants to poo-poo what I've done will also be poo-pooing, establishment authors, court historians, and they don't want to do that. So, I think that adds strength to it.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? If you're reading books, you're taking in all that information. You can't possibly put all that information into one video or one presentation. And what you're putting into it is the bits that seem the most important to you. And as you say, you often come to different conclusions to the ones that are being presented to you, especially if you're reading it in the right way, and you're imagining it, and you're imagining what it actually means to you, and from different points of view, as you were saying there, a book that is written by a Jew that is pro-Jewish about Churchill, that you might come to completely different conclusions when you're reading it as a white man, especially as someone from Britain and looking at how he lost us the British Empire, and what you come out with at the end of that is an original take on things, and that's what we're missing a lot, I think, in the age of the internet and in the age of YouTube. It's hard to find people that come out with an original take on something like the Second World War, and I think that's what was most appealing about these presentations that you did.
Yeah, when I look back on it, this was not really in my mind as I made them, but when I look back, over the 7 videos in that series, what they actually compare, I think this is where I probably differ from Dennis, although I'd like to talk to him directly about it at some point, is that I'm not making a case for Hitler. I'm not exonerating Hitler. I am exonerating him of the things that he's typically accused of, but I don't believe that nothing was his fault. I'd be interested to see, whether Dennis does as well. I'm actually not making a pro-National Socialist argument in these videos. It's in effect, it does defend them, but as I say, from what I would say are false accusations. But there are still moments where I would say Hitler was at fault, and Hitler helped helped his enemies at least by accident. In one example being his bullying attitude towards Austria. you know, he's sent troops into Austria. I think, you know, there's not really any excuse for that. On the other hand, a lot of Austrians welcomed it. So, you know, it's you know, there's different layers of things going on.
I might be able to answer that.
Just to finish, the overall effect is that I'm making a case against the I don't know what you call it, the Nuremberg thesis, as some people say, without anyone being able to say, oh, you're just a Nazi apologist, you know, because it's not actually that.
Well, so I might be able to answer that. I think what they did was actually swap troops. I think they had Austrian troops that went over into Germany and German troops that went over into Austria at the same time, because it was all like arranged beforehand. So that might answer that bit there about why the German troops were going into Austria. Yeah, I mean, also, I think what you were referring to there is one of the books. Is it The Origins of the Second World War? The AJP yeah. Taylor one. And I think that really shocked the academic world, didn't it, when that came out, because yeah. it was saying some different things. Do you want to talk a bit about that and the way that it was challenging the narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I would say about that book, as with many others, it's as interesting to study the reception of it, especially in the first, you know, weeks and months after its first release, as the book is itself. I mean, it's a very interesting book in itself. Actually, AJP Taylor was a leftist, quite strongly left-wing. I mean, he supported the Soviet Union into the 50s and 60s, maybe even further. So he was really, really left-wing, and I would say probably effectively quite anti-British, at least by our standards. But when he released that book, I mean, this is something you see again and again. You see it with the Buchanan book as well. It was castigated for it. I mean, that tendency, I would sort of generally blame that on sort of Jewish reviewers, Jewish publishers, like, you know, opinion piece publishers and so on. That they certainly lead in that. But I mean, with Taylor, it was less intense, because that tendency has grown and grown since the war, and I think is probably at its most fervent right now. Buchanan's book, it's doubtful whether that would actually be publishable at all. And that's only 20 years old. But yeah, Taylor's book, so he's not making a case for, you know, he's not making any defense of Hitler whatsoever. He absolutely hates Hitler. He also, I think, significantly completely exonerates Stalin. So, you know, this is not a guy, again, who can be accused of Nazi apology. What he is doing is just saying that it's a myth. You know, we're misunderstanding history if we think that, you know, Adolf Hitler existing simply caused the war. If you asked him, he might even dispute my characterization of it as that. Like, you know, his thesis is a bit more specific. But in effect, he says... Well, one significant thing he says is that Hitler was a fairly ordinary German statesman, obviously a bit more aggressive than others, a bit more kind of brutal in his approach. But he was trying to do much the same as like Gustav Stresemann was doing under the Weimar Republic and several of the others. And they were not castigated for it. Well, they probably were by some. Whereas Hitler has had attributed to him the whole war. And That is ridiculous. That is ridiculous. Hitler was trying to resolve far smaller things. And his main concern was just not to let Bolshevism take over Europe, which is a moderate aim. I mean, it's a good aim. That's a morally good thing. The Bolsheviks really were, you know, the evil that Hitler is accused of, the Bolsheviks undisputably were. You know, whereas with Hitler, the evidence just doesn't bear it out. As I said, I don't exonerate Hitler of everything. But, AJP Taylor's book, you know, it's intended. I think probably one factor as well is that he was someone who liked shocking people as well. But it's still a good book. And I think, Taylor was just trying to say, look, you've all built up a kind of hysterical image of Hitler. Stop doing that. You know, it doesn't help anyone. And kind of by accident, he wrote a book that I don't know about by accident, but that helps bring a lot of realism to the subject.
Well, Hitler does get blamed for absolutely everything. When you think about it, after the Treaty of Versailles, Germany was in a really bad way. Germany had been blamed for everything in the First World War, and up to right near the end of the First World War, it looked like they were going to win the war, and suddenly they lost, and suddenly they were blamed for everything. And you had the Weimar Republic, you had everybody being really poor, you had Germany being chopped up into little pieces and handed out to these other countries. Nobody was actually happy at the end of the Treaty of Versailles. There wasn't one country in Europe that said, well, that was a great treaty. Now we're never going to have another war again. Everybody said, well, that's just setting the scene for another war. How can you do that to Germany? And then you get up to the Danzig situation, and Hitler has always been blamed for that as if he was just invading Poland because he wanted to take it over. And it was, you know, it was really just because he wanted to join up part of Danzig to the German people with a railway there. I mean, it's quite reasonable. But the Poles wouldn't have it. Then, you know, there's so much history to it that people just aren't taught at all. And I think really AJ Taylor, that was one of the things that really shocked people, is that he was saying, well, he had the support of Germany for going into Poland, and it was actually a reasonable thing for him to do, because the Germans themselves were being brutalized and mistreated by the Poles by that time as well. Is that what he was sort of saying in that book? Is that part of it?
I can't remember what Taylor says about Danzig. I mean, he definitely says that the wheels of war were already in motion before that. The die had pretty much been cast before that. But yeah, I think, I mean, Institute for Historical Review have done good work on that, about the Polish side in that conflict. And it was, you know, the Polish were doing extremely provocative things, and yeah, they did murder some civilians. The numbers are hard to tell, but there were Poles murdering German civilians and getting away with it. And apparently the Polish press was hysterically anti-German and pro-war. There were a lot of Poles who really thought that they could withstand Germany. They were wrong, obviously. But I mean, just about the invasion of Poland, apparently that is an invasion to study. It wasn't just that the Germans, they did have a mightier army, but it wasn't just that. They actually fought that brilliantly, and that's how they managed to, but also they conquer it very quickly. But they also had the advantage, obviously, that the Soviets came in from the other side as well. It's a really, really horrible situation. I mean, you know, you don't wish that upon the Poles. but yeah, I mean, one thing, just as you mentioned, the First World War, I absolutely agree that maybe it would be an overstatement to say that the Treaty of Versailles guaranteed the Second World War, but nearly. I mean, it's not far off a guarantee. I think, you know, nearly all the conditions that led to the war flowed directly from that. But and one thing about the end of the First World War, I think, is very significant. I encourage people to watch this speech by John Denson. It's from the Mises Institute, which is a libertarian, American libertarian think tank. But then they do some very good anti-war material, including by Ralph Rako. But this speech by John Denson, I think it's called 6 Months That Changed the World. And it's about the Versailles Conference, which lasted about 6 months. And he mentions at one point, and this I was simply never taught this anywhere on TV or in school or anything, and it's that Britain had Germany under blockade from the armistice until the Treaty of Versailles was signed. And in that time, that blockade probably led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of German civilians. So it was a treaty achieved by strangulation. And basically, I don't know, what do you call that? Like, I mean, genocide is probably too strong, but, you know, mass slaughter of civilians in peacetime. So it's, you know, if you call that peacetime, you know, after the armistice was signed, I think it's very significant, you know, that to have a revisionist view of the First World War as well. And Patrick Buchanan does that in The Unnecessary War. He links it all. And I think that's absolutely the right approach. You know, it can be seen as one ongoing conflict. And I would say the other constant, the other condition that was really, really important in causing both the wars and so many problems in the 20th century was Britain's alliance with France. That's a terrible alliance. The effects of that alliance have been awful, absolutely awful.
Tell us some more about that, because I've always thought about it was the blank check that was given to Poland and encouraging them to go to war to Germany, and that was the worst thing that we did. So can you tell us some more about what you see as, you know, between the alliance with France?
Sure, yeah. Well, the guarantee that Britain gave to Poland in early 1939, I would say that, you know, and Buchanan says quite clearly that was one of the most like disastrous diplomatic decisions in British history, maybe the number one. Yeah, it gave Poland every reason to be intransigent towards Germany, whereas without that, they probably would have made an alliance with Germany, because ultimately, if forced to choose between the dictatorships on either side, the German one was more benign. So that would have been a good thing. Instead, it made them try and stand up for themselves absolutely futilely. They had no chance. They needed to choose to side either with Germany and the Soviets. And that alliance signaled to them to stand alone and sort of gave them the idea that Britain would come to their help, which it never did. But about the British-French alliance, yeah, well, yeah, I'm at the limits of my knowledge. I'm not sure exactly. They call it the Entente Cordiale, right? I'm not sure exactly why that formed. It might have been an anti-German thing in the first place. I think it was formalised around the start of the 20th century. Was probably in effect a bit before, but yeah, I mean, like there was an anti-German prejudice or an anti-German faction in the British ruling class at least 10 years before the First World War, like that was already very explicit and I think organized and funded and so on, which certainly included much of the Foreign Office. In connection with the Foreign Office, I would mention Robert Van Sitter, who's a very important figure in the 1930s, an extreme anti-German head of the Foreign Office, obsessively anti-German. And that was before before Hitler got in, so it wasn't against fascism, it was against Germany. But that attitude, I mean, you know, the Foreign Office had produced him as their head by 1930, so there was often that, you know, that disease was already there a long time before for him to get that high by that point. But yeah, Britain and France had by the eve of the First World War, they were sort of in lockstep, and there's no good reason for that. They got different interests, they got different, you know, all over the world they had different interests. I mean, there's, you know, I want friendship with France, but an alliance is a different matter, because that means you basically endorse their aggression or their bellicosity towards other countries. So an alliance is a far more dangerous thing. And yeah, just before First World War started, I think within, you know, in the week or two before it started, Edward Grey, who I think was the Foreign Secretary at that time, not quite sure, and Winston Churchill, who I believe was Lord of the Admiralty, obviously very important back then, they made a secret intimation to the French politicians that Britain had the French northern coast covered navally, and that the French could therefore move their naval fleets all towards the south, like, or into the Mediterranean or the Bay of Biscay or whatever, which meant that France then behaved as though its northern coast was secure. But in British policy, like, nothing had actually been established. That was just an understanding given to them in private by two British, leading British politicians. That meant that France responded to Germany in a way far more aggressive than Germany could have anticipated, and, you know, in these verbal arguments that were going on all that year. That made France bellicose. You see there the effect of alliances, that it adds to the chances of war. So an alliance should generally be seen as an aggressive thing, not always, but often. In the period between the First and the Second World War, I think that the alliance was to blame again. I'm not even sure if it was a formal alliance, but at every stage, Britain did signal to France that they backed them, you know, vis-a-vis Germany. And it meant that everything that France found threatening, Britain responded to as a threat as well. And to France, everything Germany did was threatening, right? So this is how this myth developed, that simply the rise of Hitler caused the war. No, it didn't. That was a threat to the Soviets, if anyone. It wasn't a threat to France. Germany, yeah, wanted Alsace and Lorraine back, but both sides had claims to that. I don't think Hitler actually had any plan to get those things back. All his ambitions were in the East, as he made clear again and again and again. But this attitude that Britain had to stick up for France meant that it was easier and easier for the anti-German faction in Britain to portray Germany as a threat. And that's what I criticised Hitler for in terms of his sort of brutal attitude towards the Austrians and the Czechs, in that he fed, by doing those things, he fed the anti-German faction in Britain, which I think he underestimated. That's part of the tragedy. Because if only he'd conciliated better with at least some of the British ruling class, he might have been able to prevent the war.
I think he may have been under the impression that a much better impression of the British upper classes than they actually were. I mean, when you look at Rudolf Hess coming over expecting to meet up with them and the way he was treated, I mean, it shows, and also allowing the British troops to come back from Dunkirk and not trying to imprison them or do anything else, and trusting that Churchill would then stand down and realise that he should have been asked to surrender then, but he wasn't. The troops were allowed to come back. So I think Hitler very much overestimated the honour and the decency of Churchill and the upper classes. And just to go back to France there, I think maybe the French wouldn't have been too happy about this secret deal. Maybe they wouldn't have been too happy about what the results of that were either, because Churchill destroyed the fleet, didn't he? He destroyed the naval fleet once Germany had actually come in and they'd come to a peace and they'd had an armistice. And then Churchill destroyed the naval fleet and set up communist resistance that he called the French resistance. They were all just terrorists. And I think this would have been against the will of the French people. So you've got like a force there, probably aligned with the bankers more than anybody else, which I don't think the French people would have supported that much. I think that ties in with what you're saying there about this secret alliance, which I wasn't aware of until you brought it up.
Well, yeah, that secret promise that he made to the French, sorry, that was in 1914. That was him and Edward Grey made that just before the start of the First World War, about Britain guaranteeing the northern coast of France. So that encouraged the French to be bellicose in summer and autumn of 1914.
Would that have continued though? Because the alliance was obviously still there by the Second War, wasn't it?
I don't know whether that still applied. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think not. I think it wasn't even official the first time. It shouldn't really. I mean, the French shouldn't have taken it seriously. They should have said, "We want that on paper." But it suited the anti-German forces in French politics. So that's probably why it was accepted. These scumbag warmongers, they scheme. They're devious and they're dishonest. So that's part of how these things happen, tragically. I think of Churchill as a man with no morals whatsoever, none. Well, not none, that's probably overstating it, but a really immoral or amoral person.
Yeah, we've done a series. Well, Dennis is working on a new documentary series, and we've used the transcripts to do a series on Churchill's body count. It's just incredible the way he treated the British people in Gallipoli and elsewhere, and the way that he behaved at sea as well, putting weapons on civilian ships and false flag attacks and all sorts. But just to go back there, what you were saying about this anti-German faction, one of your videos is to do with the Soviet ambassador to Britain. And I should imagine he was encouraging that and encouraging this anti-German faction. Would I be right there? Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that you picked out in the notes that you made before this show was the line that Ivan Maisky, the Soviet ambassador, found at least a large part of the British ruling class already so anti-German that pretty much all he had to do was just have them around for dinner, and they were looking for him. Like they were looking to ally with him. And there's one scene that I describe in the Maisky diaries. This is 2 years before the war. So we're talking before the Munich conference, before the supposed betrayal of Czechoslovakia. This would have been shortly before the Anschluss with Austria, I think. So before all these things that are cited as causes of the war, Winston Churchill was at a the King was hosting a reception for the Belgian King. Winston Churchill was there along with many other people. Von Ribbentrop was there. bad choice. That was a bad decision by Hitler, sending Ribbentrop to Britain. Ivan Maisky was there. And at one point, Churchill was talking to the king and turned away from him to talk to the Soviet ambassador. No, that wasn't how it happened. Churchill was talking to the Soviet ambassador, already looking quite friendly. The king assumed that something must be wrong, went and tried to rescue Churchill from the conversation. Churchill sort of tolerated him for a minute and then turned back to his conversation with the Soviet ambassador. Symbolically, I think that's very striking. But yeah, Ivan Maisky found himself plenty of very willing allies. So I think it's really, really significant that already by 1936-37, obviously this is before the war that supposedly demonstrates that, you know, any sort of white identitarianism or racial nationalism is the ultimate evil, before that was established by the Holocaust and so on, you know, as we're taught now. It was already the case that you could openly collude with the Soviets, easily the worst government in the world, or the most dangerous government in the world, against the Germans, who expressly wanted peace and potentially an alliance with us. That standard had already been established before the war by people like Winston Churchill, Robert Van Sitter, who I mentioned before. David Lloyd George was in on it. I think Ramsay MacDonald encouraged it. You also had Lord Beaverbrook, who owned The Express, the biggest newspaper in the world at the time. Very, very friendly with Churchill and Maisky. You also had the Webbs, who founded the Fabian Society, who were very important. They were old by then, but still. You had loads of important people were just keen to hang around with the Soviet ambassador. And to the point where, yeah, he really just had to kind of be there. He just had to be there, like, to be... I would call it the Maisky Circle. It's maybe a little bit too acute. Maybe it puts a little too much credit on him. Credit in an ironic, you know, in a dark sense. But a nest of people who were determined to join the Soviets in war against Germany were already formed around Maisky at least 2 years before the war and before all these events that supposedly prove the danger of Hitler.
And they can't say that they didn't know what the Soviets were like. Winston Churchill himself warned what the Soviets were like. There was intelligence briefings that said about the Bolsheviks and the killings and the gulags and all that sort of stuff they knew about. And yet here they are still getting friendly with them. I would suggest that that's due to the bankers, basically. The same bankers were operating the Soviets and operating Stalin as were operating Churchill, and they didn't like the king either. I mean, they got rid of the king, didn't they? And just
right. Yeah, I mean, the change in Churchill is very, very interesting, and I don't really have the answers for it. I've not read Irving's books on it, and there's loads more I need to study. But Churchill did... to his credit, as a younger man, I think still after the Bolshevik Revolution, he was one of the leading voices against the Soviet Union. So he didn't have any love for the Soviet Union, even when he was scheming with their ambassador. It wasn't because there's no suggestion that he supported or was soft on communism. He was anti-communist explicitly. Excuse me. And at least one article, I think in the 1930s, probably the first half, at least one newspaper article, he himself discussed the massive extent of their atrocities against their own civilians. So it was widely known about, and he was one of the people who made it widely known about. But over the 1930s, yeah, he got bought off somehow. The most establishment-friendly explanation would be that he just deduced that the Germans were just a far greater threat. But there's no basis for thinking that. I think really what happened, yeah, I mean, this thing called the focus that David Irving talks about, that's definitely a factor. The fact that Churchill, as I say in the video, Churchill and the Jews, and you can find this out in the book, you know, this is not... my own speculation or anything. This is all proven. He was raised at least from after his father died, which was, I think, in Churchill's late teens. He was raised by, groomed by three particular mega rich Jews, like I can't remember which of the Rothschilds it was. I think it was just Lord Rothschild, but there were loads of Rothschilds. Maurice de Hirsch and Edmund Cassell, three of the richest people in the world, who were all close to King Edward the VII as well. He had what some people called a Jewish court. So Churchill would spend his whole life around strongly ethnocentric Zionist Jews. So that's a factor as well. He also just, you know, had just a very, very strong Judeophilia and was a Zionist, you know, his whole career. And from his first few years in Parliament, he was always concerned with I don't know, being on the Jewish side. But yeah, so he obviously didn't see the Soviet Union as a Jewish, you know, some people would say that the Soviet Union should be understood, as a Jewish regime, you know, and the National Socialists had this sort of canard of Judeo-Bolshevism. I think that is not unfair, but it is possible to overstate. It's not simply a Jewish regime, and I think it's significant that Stalin was not Jewish. Some people say he was, but I think that's not true. I think that some things that the Soviets did get attributed to Jews like Kaganovich or Yagoda, and these men were bad men, but I think Stalin was genuinely at the top of all that. So it's wrong to just simply call it a Jewish regime. And Churchill certainly didn't see it as such. He saw it as the bad. I mean, he was aware of the Jewish element in it. And he thought it was letting down the reputation of Jews. So he thought it was actually bad for Jews. I don't know. There's a lot of factors that made, or the other one that David Irving talks about is that Winston Churchill was also being directly and very lavishly bribed by the Czech government in the 1930s. He was simply paid to be anti-German, and I find that perfectly plausible because Churchill was terrible with money, and as I said before, was amoral. I don't think he would think anything wrong of that, as long as, you know, he was just the sort of person who could convince himself that what he was doing was right, whatever it was. So I think he's that, you know, a very inconstant person who was easily bought. So I think that's a factor. Just one other thing I would add about the Makey Diaries is that that book came out about 5 or 6 years ago now. As far as I'm aware, that's not been incorporated into the official history of the Second World War. That's not a rigid thing, the official history, but what I would call, you know, the establishment narrative. It's not been incorporated in it, and it ought to be, because it makes very important revelations about Churchill and about Makey and so on.
So that's really some original research that you're doing there, that you're bringing to people's attention, drawing people's attention to it and how it fits in. But it hasn't been done before.
I'm not aware of anyone else making videos about this stuff, but these books are out there. You know, it's our fault if we fail to read them, I suppose.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we're the people that need to be drawing attention to this. I mean, I try to draw attention to the hidden aspects of British history. There's particularly one bit with Edward Longshanks, and the story we've been told about him is the complete opposite of what the original source documents tell us about him. And unless you actually look for this stuff and then make it available, nobody knows about it. And we have this totally false view of history. I think I would go along with you there, what you're saying about the Bolsheviks. I think it was the worst of the Jews and the worst of the Gentiles, and both of them together bringing out absolute horrors. I mean, Stalin did have Jewish mistresses and Jewish wives, and there was certainly a Jewish flavor to communism, which was highlighted upon and maybe exaggerated in some ways by the National Socialists. But I think they had a genuine threat from the Jews themselves that were in Germany, due to the number of Jews there were in Europe that were supporting communism, and a lot of these partisans as well that were calling themselves French Resistance and that were in the East as well. They were all Jewish, and calling themselves these other names. So I think there was a genuine threat there. But you were talking about how Hitler pretty much saved the West of Europe from Bolshevism, and that was the main threat, and that was what he was trying to put down, and that comes across in one of your videos. I'm not sure which one it is, and you were referring to Icebreaker, Viktor Shuvanov's book at the beginning here, and I think from his from his book, that's the one that talks about Stalin massing all these tanks on the border ready to invade Europe, because that's the one that is cited most to say that Operation Barbarossa was really defensive. It was about defending Western Europe rather than invading Russia, which is the narrative that we have today. Is that's in one of your presentations, isn't it? Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Just to respond to what you said, but yeah, I think the term Judeo-Bolshevism is not unjustified. It's just possible to be sort of to use it in too exaggerated a form, but there absolutely is a close relationship between Jews and Marxism and communism. Obviously, not all Jews are Marxists, and not all Marxists are Jews, but there's a great deal of overlap. And arguably, some people would argue, I think Douglas Reed in The Controversy of Zion argues that communism was more or less invented by what he calls the Talmudic government. It's really, really interesting. To serve the same purpose, i.e. global Jewish power and control over the rest of the world, as Zionism. It's sort of two swords working, I don't know, two aspects of the same project, it's a really interesting theory. I'm not sure what to think of that yet. But the threat of Bolshevism was not contained within the Soviet Union. Obviously, Germany had at least, I think, 8 communist or Marxist revolts internally. Some more threatening than others. I mean, one of them, I think, was put down in just a day or two, but another one took over a whole region and held it for weeks. And these were almost all led by Jews. So, by no means did he not have reason to use the term Judeo-Bolshevism. That was it's a real thing. It's just, we have to be specific about what we mean by it. But Viktor Suvorov and Icebreaker and The Chief Culprit, his books, I haven't actually read those because I was informed by the IHR. I get loads from that website. I recommend everyone, Institute Historical Review. Everyone check it out. I've learned so much from that website. One review on there of... his name, Joachim Hoffman's book, Stalin's War of Extermination, said that book incorporates all the best of Suvorov and leaves out his more speculative stuff. So I just read Hoffman instead to save myself that effort. And sure enough, he incorporates Suvorov and various other authors that support this thesis that when Germany attacked the Soviet Union in, was it June 1941, the Soviets were about two to four weeks away from doing the same in the other direction. They were about to invade Germany through Poland and Ukraine. Obviously, they occupied eastern Poland by then, and Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. One of the reasons why the Soviet losses in those first few weeks of Barbarossa was so appalling, and they literally lost millions of men in the first couple of months. In great encirclements, brilliantly carried out by the Wehrmacht. One of the reasons why that was so successful was because all the Soviet troops, well, not all, nearly all, their preparations were nearly complete. They were almost all already in attack positions. They were in positions that were pretty much useless for defending. On the other hand, what's also interesting about that is that according to Hoffman's thesis, which I find totally persuasive, I think it's consistent with all the facts, as opposed to what we're told about it being a surprise attack by the Germans and Stalin being shocked. What actually happened, right? Because, there's this famous spell of a few days where nobody could get Stalin out of his room. He was apparently so horrified and shocked that he couldn't face the reality of it, and he just hid in his room for a few days
and wasn't giving orders. Breakdown. Yeah, we were told he had a nervous breakdown. Yeah, tell us more.
So that's a really interesting fact. And Hoffman says it's not that Stalin was just so stunned by Hitler's perfidy, as if Stalin was never perfidious, as if Stalin would be shocked by anyone else's perfidy. What it was that Stalin knew the risk he was taking in massing his troops. He knew that it was very likely that the Germans would detect that. I mean, how could you not? As long as you've got at least a few spies or some sort of intelligence. What he expected was that his forces were so much greater in number And they outstripped the German numbers by, I think, five times over, at least in every category, in some categories more. And I mean tanks, paratroopers, air, you know, fighters and so on. Because his forces were so great, the Germans would bounce off. And in fact, what happened was, you know, whatever numbers the Soviets had, their morale was terrible, because the morale of the Red Army was almost totally founded on propaganda and terror. And in fact, in the 24 years since the Soviets had taken over, they'd won over hardly anyone to their cause in spirit. All they'd done was terrorize and kill their people. So the Soviet forces at least didn't want to fight, and to a large extent, a large proportion of them wanted to join the Germans even. I don't know whether either side expected that, because the Germans didn't seem to have any plan for that. But yeah, that is what is explained in the video I did, which is named after Hoffman's book, Stalin's War of Extermination. Absolutely crucial book. This one, unlike the Majski Diaries, never will, you know, Majski Diaries hasn't been incorporated into the establishment narrative, but Hoffman cannot be, because it means that Stalin's the worst baddie, and they, you know, everything is built on avoiding that. The other thing I'll just respond to the last thing you said was, about this great the role of Jews in the partisan war and the resistances and so on. Just talking about the Eastern theater, the Eastern Front, I think it's very, very significant. I learned about this from a book. I deal with this in the video I did called The Judean German War, which is partly based on more stuff from the IHR and partly based on the book, again by a Jew, Benjamin Ginsberg, called How the Jews Defeated Hitler. And basically what that book is just an honest scholar. His persuasion is obviously just very, very pro-Jewish, anti-Nazi and so on. But in terms of the facts, he's very, very honest and straightforward. He just said Jews had this role in causing the war, Jews had this role in winning the war. And it's absolutely brilliant for people who just want to find out info. And Andrew Joyce did a review of that a few years ago in Occidental Observer. Anyone who's not reading Joyce, what are you doing? Anyone who's not reading Occidental Observer, get involved. I learned about that book. What it did is it changed my view of the killing of Jewish civilians. Now, I would say anyone who denies the Holocaust to the extent that they say that the Germans didn't kill any Jewish civilians, that would be ridiculous, right? Because on the Eastern Front, what you had, as the Germans advanced, right, you had Slavs, Eastern European peoples, who, they didn't necessarily welcome the German advance, because the German advance was, you know, depending on which officer was in charge of this or that area, could be very, very brutal, or in some cases was benign. It really, really varied, varied based on the officers in charge, I think, and the troops to what extent they were under control and so on. So that, you know, there was, you know, a great variety of treatment of the civilians. But Jews, unlike the Slavs, very much welcomed Soviet rule if that was the choice, you know, if they had a choice between Soviet and Nazi rule, because obviously, whether truthfully or not, they believed that the Nazis were a terrible danger to them. And so they were extremely fervent in joining partisan activities against the Germans. And obviously, Jews had a great, a far higher status in the Soviet Union than they'd ever had under the Russian Empire and stuff. So they were, you know, a lot of them were favorable to the Soviet Union. And as that retreated and the Germans took over, naturally, they made themselves a massive problem for the German occupation. The Germans were already, I think, badly prepared for occupying such a vast area. They had expected that the Soviets would collapse, and they didn't. So the Germans found themselves occupying ever and ever larger area with, yeah, these hundreds of thousands of Jewish civilians under them, many of whom were saboteurs or were, you know, assassinating officers and so on. So a lot of the killing would have resulted from that, right? From, unfortunately, horrible as it is to say, but necessity. That changed my view of what they call the Holocaust. You know, when they say, you know, 6 million Jews were murdered by the Germans, no, probably some much smaller number of Jewish civilians died under the German area of occupation. And of those, many should be considered combatants. And then others, yeah, probably, as is accused of the Germans, probably quite a lot died in the concentration camps, like is suggested by that International Red Cross report that shows that, you know, some a far more credible report, you know, that shows that people were dying of disease in quite large numbers in Auschwitz, and that there was no sign of, well, I don't know, what is there any sort of limit on what I can say on here?
No. No, as long as you're not inciting hate, then or violence, you're fine. You can say whatever.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah. So the story of gas chambers, I think, was largely imposed in the last sort of 6 to 8 months of the war, especially by Ilya Ehrenberg, who was one of the top few leading propagandists of the Soviet Union. And when I say leading propagandists, he wasn't just writing in the Soviet newspapers. He was being published all over the world, especially New York and London. And he especially was the one who started coming out with these things of, you know, 500,000 people have already been murdered at Majdanek, and, you know, 4 million have been murdered at Auschwitz, you know, and that got written on a plaque at the Auschwitz site. And I have held in my hand a bar of soap with Jew soap written on it and stuff. He's the source of so many of those things, which have ludicrously been made, been given the status of history, though, where, you know, the evidence simply does not bear it out. But, yeah, so I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, I was just thinking there as well. When the Germans came in and they liberated areas like Lithuania and Latvia, places that had been under Soviet rule for a couple of years, where you were mentioning there about how the Jews supported the Soviets because they had a high position in the Soviet society, higher than the position they had before. So when the Soviets were they were running the administration, these Jews were quite high up. So if they didn't manage to escape in time with the Soviets before the Germans then came in and liberated those countries, the Jews that were left behind, they were the subject to reprisals from the very people themselves. And the Germans had to try and prevent that. In some cases, the Germans were trying to prevent this. And there were some areas where it was really bad because of the mistreatment that these people had under these Jewish commissars. And then they saw the Germans as, you know, not so bad after all. They were sort of coming in to liberate them. But, and then when you got the next lot coming in for the third time, when the Soviets came in the last time, that was when they were even more brutal with these Slavs, basically, because of the way that they'd been with the Germans, because they'd welcomed these German liberators. You know, you have to really feel sorry for people in the Baltics and in Lithuania and Latvia, and the way that they were treated.
There was like a massive orgy of score settling all across the Eastern Front, right, among the civilians, between Slavs and Baltic people and Romanians and so on, and Jews. And it was partly because of the sort of prominent role that Jews had in supporting or staffing the Soviet Union. And also, I would imagine, scores that go back decades or centuries before that, right? And also, like, I mean, from what my knowledge is a bit scanty about this, but from what I've read from some sources, Jews have been involved in very, very exploitative practices against, especially in Poland, I've heard this, just deliberately taking control of whole industries and excluding all other producers of the local, you know, the natives, like, so especially in Poland, they say, or deliberate promotion of like bawdy houses and, you know, bordellos and stuff, things like that, that were seen as, you know, corrosive to the society. I imagine that was a factor as well. And in Germany, I mean, in that video I did, the Judean German War, I explain, well, you know, based on the sources that I've read, I'd be interested if anyone disputes this, but Jews had established, you know, a very, very intense control in parts of Germany over the media, over the justice system. Nobody's going to like that. You know, it's not specific to Jews. Like, you know, if you get people from Africa doing that here, I'm not going to like that, you know, and especially if they're using their control against the natives, there's going to be ethnic resentment, right? And so the war, the situation, is one of the horrors of war, is that there's often a gap between the advancing army and the retreating one. And in that gap, you get mob rule, mob justice, or, you know, an opportunity for settling old feuds, and nasty things are going to happen, criminal things are going to happen. So, yeah, I mean, that, you know, part of what is called the Holocaust is actually just the tragedy of war. War mullahs civilians, especially in the modern age. War has a terrible effect on civilians.
Did you
nothing special about the Jewish suffering, right? You know, the Slavic suffering is just as evil. So
it goes covered up, doesn't it? I mean, people don't even know that the people know the number of Jews killed in the war, but they don't know the number of Europeans. Did you ever see the Versailles Treaty? The Poles, because the Jews held such a high position in Poland at the time, they were actually arguing at the treaties for them to be given more rights than the Poles themselves, and to have their own areas and their own governments and their own laws. And it's quite interesting to see. I think it's in Henry Ford's book, which was written before the Second World War, and that's his complaint about the Versailles Treaty, is the way the Jews were in Poland. Totally different to what everybody today looks at when they look at the Versailles Treaty. It's that really shows you that the level of control that they had. And where you were mentioning what they had there in Germany, they were also promoting all this degeneracy, weren't they, with the sex doctor, Hermann Magnusfeld or something like that?
Magnus Hirschfeld, yeah.
That's it, yeah, and homosexuality and transgenderism and all these sorts of things. And you had a very moral population. I mean, Luther was born in Germany. Protestantism began there. So you had a very moral people. And they had these plays that were promoting divorce and homosexuality and lesbianism.
Child prostitution.
Yeah, all this sort of stuff. So there's going to be a backlash against that. It all ties in together. And with the communism that's being promoted as well. Some of those communist republics that they had in Germany, they were encouraging free sex and sex with children as well, and abolishing marriage. That was the first
thing. Never let it be denied that there's a relationship between the far left and sex abuse of children. There's a consistent relationship, at least through the last century. Wherever the hard left, you know, the Marxist or anarchist communist left take control, paedophilia seems to become, if not legal, at least done quite openly. That seems to be a thing, you know, throughout a large part of history.
Am I right in thinking you came from the left to this, to nationalism? You were involved in the left in some way before then?
Well, just when I was about 15, I took my first interest in politics, and the first idea that ever appealed to me was communism. Yeah, it was. And so when I was being taught about the Russian Revolution, I was cheering for Lenin and so on. But that started falling away when I was about 17, 18, 19. By the time I was about 20, I broke from that quite significantly and never went back. But I would say even then it took me another 10 years, maybe more, to really shed all my leftist ideas. I saw a flashback on Facebook to something I posted about, I think, 7 years ago. And I was cheering on Antifa against the English Defence League. So I still had strong remnants of the anti-racism disease that they preach to us when we're children.
Was
still working on me not that long ago. So I've broken from it now. But yeah.
Was it concern for others that sort of drew you to the left? Was it concern for others or just a destructive urge? Because, I think a lot of these people on the left, they're just misinformed. I think a lot of them do have... they're concerned for other people, and that's why they get involved in it. But they've just misinformed. Was it concern for others or destruction? What encouraged? I think
it was a sense of fairness, a very very vague sense of fairness, because I was sold or just sort of soaked in that idea that a great many people hold, and I would say. I mean, I grew up around people who mostly work in education, so they sort of generally lean left, although they're not really radicals in, you know, the people I know. But the idea was common that communism is a nice idea that doesn't work in practice, right? Whereas now I believe that it's not a nice idea, let alone how it works in practice. But I had soaked up that idea. Basically communism was presented to me as everything's shared out. Everyone gets what they need from the common pool of resources. And I was like, well, why is the world not like that already? Why are we not all looked after already? Why do we have to have this precariousness? Obviously, that's not what communism means. Communism means the state takes control of everything. And then if you're lucky, if everything goes perfectly, somehow the state ceases to exist and we all just get along. But it was presented to me in its most benign possible interpretation.
So I think that goes for most, I think that goes for most people are misinformed, and their actual drives are towards justice, and that's why they have to come down so heavy on the censorship, because they can't, you know, they can't chance the truth getting out, because once people hear the truth, then they join us. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Horace. That's been great. That's really informative. I'm sure the listeners will have loved listening to you today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back next week with more Truth Without Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.